Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Of course, the Senator for Victoria since 1996, Deputy Leader of the Opposition Senate since 2001, had a number of shadow ministries, including finally Shadow Minister for Communication and Information Technology. But since the election of the Rudd Labor government, Senator Conroy, of course, is Deputy Leader of the Government in the Senate and Minister for Broadband, Communication and the Digital Economy. And tonight he's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on broadband and the digital economy. Senator Conroy, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you, Jared. And thank you for the invitation to be here today. The Sydney Institute is an important forum for serious discussion and debate of public policy and policy reform. With many significant developments in my portfolio area underway, today presents a great opportunity to outline the government's digital economy agenda. Last week, I attended the National ICT Australia's Tech Fest, where they were showcasing 20 outstanding research projects. And this really was an exciting glimpse of our future. It was fascinating listening to these researchers talking about what they see, where they see technology taking us into the next decade. NICTA lab manager, Dr. Terry Percival, talked about a future where ICT addressed some of the major problems we face in the world today. In the area of healthcare, for example, he spoke of a preemptive system where doctors would call patients before they got sick. Dr. Percival also envisaged a much cleaner world, where ICT has drastically reduced energy consumption, improved public transport, and even removed the need for work-related travel. I suspect many people would approve of all of these developments. No doubt everyone in this room has heard the phrase digital economy. You may have also noticed that my department has been renamed to make this an explicit focus. I'm often asked why this government places such an important policy focus on the digital economy. The answer is that how we manage the digital economy will have a profound effect on our economic performance and the lives of all Australians. Our future prosperity will be bound to the growth of the digital economy. In essence, the digital economy encapsulates the framework within which increasing levels of economic activity and social interaction will take place into the future. The convergence of technological platforms is changing the way services and applications are being delivered. We truly are moving into a new frontier. Around the world, policymakers are grappling with how to ensure their countries harness these benefits. Countries that embrace them will prosper. In many ways, the digital economy is already booming. ICT is already entwined in our economic and social fabric in areas as diverse as financial markets, government services, social networking, entertainment, and telephony. Fueled by the increasing pervasiveness and power of the internet, ICT is changing the nature of economic activity and social interaction. New services and applications are increasingly viewed as essential by consumers and businesses. You do not have to look far to see this. Take the business sector as an example. Businesses are using ICT and the internet to revolutionise their systems and their processes in order to improve efficiency and promote innovation. Old business models are giving way to new ones. In some cases, competition is just as likely to come from overseas as down the road. technological change is breaking down the tyranny of distance. Consumers are also benefiting. They are watching IPTV and vodcasts, making travel arrangements online, enjoying cheaper phone calls through voice over IP technology, and roaming through virtual worlds such as Second Life. But I have to say that there are some who say if you're on Second Life, you should be calling it First Life because you obviously don't have one. But it's catching on. I don't know if you saw CSI New York recently had an entire episode based around a cop pursuit through Second Life. It was fascinating to watch. And now, not only are these services and applications changing, but so too are the platforms over which they are being delivered. Content and connectivity is now available to businesses and consumers in the office or on the move. Indeed, the mobility of services is now an accepted feature of modern day life. Perhaps some of the most exciting possibilities in the transition to the digital economy are in the education and health sectors. Schools and universities are increasingly using the internet for education and research. Using the internet, students can remotely access audio or video recordings of lectures and better participate in distance education. Researchers can use the internet to collaborate with colleagues around the world, accelerating the development and availability of scientific breakthroughs. The link between investment in education and broader economic benefits is well accepted. Equipping current and future generations with the best possible technological opportunities will enable Australia to make an effective transition towards a knowledge-based economy. Improvements in ICT, particularly if underpinned by the widespread availability and affordability of higher-speed broadband, will further open up the possibilities for improved distance learning education. We are also on the cusp of exciting developments in the e-health sector. Some doctors and hospitals are already diagnosing patients remotely. I was in Bunbury recently, and there was an accident in the Kimberley. A guy at a mining site had hit his hand, and they were worried it was fractured. So they took the x-ray, beamed it down to the doctor sitting next to me in Bunbury, and he diagnosed. It was an absolutely brilliantly clear x-ray. And he was able to diagnose it. No, he had a very sore hand, but he hadn't broken anything. So this is a sort of, as I said, exciting potential. High-quality video conferencing facilities allow for this via real-time interaction between patients and doctors in separate locations. The Veterans Association of America has implemented a remote patient monitoring system. As a result of this scheme, hospitalisation has been reduced by up to 60% because they detect before it reaches that crisis point. No more sending the ambulances out trying to keep them alive, you're getting to them beforehand. The social benefit of this type of program, which allows older people to stay at home and retain independence, is enormous. And along with this, there are huge economic savings, particularly if we project into the future and recognise that Australia has an ageing population. Now, harnessing the potential of the digital economy is critical for Australia's long-term economic prosperity and international competitive standing. But it will also be critical for promoting social cohesion and even cultural depth. Obviously, the availability and affordability of first-class internet services for all Australians is one of the key elements in harnessing this potential. Recent statistics provide an interesting snapshot of the internet and the effect it's already having on our lives. As at March 2008, there were over 1.3 billion internet users worldwide. More and more people are going online to do business. Over 25% of the people in the OECD ordered goods or services online in 2007. 25%. While over 30% of the OECD population performed online banking activities. But the internet is also helping people in more tangible, intangible ways. 45% of internet users in the US reported that the internet helped them make big decisions. And in Korea, a country where 94% of households are connected, users report positive effects on their lives, such as convenience, promotion of civic rights, participation in politics, and an increase in leisure time. In the 2008 Digital Future Project, which is a study of internet usage in the United States, 45% of users said that the internet was important or very important in helping them to maintain their social relationships. In Australia, the most recent ABS stats show that at the end of 2007, there were 7.1 million internet subscribers in Australia. They also show that where available, there is an increasing demand for higher speed broadband services. And it's not just email and banking that people are using the internet for. Roy Morgan data shows that nearly 60% of users have downloaded audio material, while more than 30% have either streamed or downloaded internet video. Now, just 3 years ago, when I first took over the communications portfolio, serious experts said to me, oh, look, Steve, don't worry, you don't need that much broadband width. No one wants to move video around the net. And then not long after that, a couple of geeks invented YouTube. And YouTube reported recently that nearly 4 million Australians visited their site in January, up a staggering 74% from the year before. Okay, hands up. Who's been on YouTube? Okay, that's not bad. That's not bad. Normally in audiences of this maturity, it's a little less. But it's great to see that it's penetrating much broader than just kids under the age of 25. But that's a staggering figure. Nearly 4 million Australians visited YouTube in January. Increasingly, the internet is being viewed by some as an essential facility in much the same way as gas, electricity, and the telephone. A recent report by ACMA indicated that Australians already see the internet as an essential part of their lives. 70% of household consumers indicated that broadband is a, and I quote, critical service for the future. The internet is also increasingly being used as a mechanism for interaction and consultation between government and the broader community. Research posted last month showed that a quarter of all Australians now conduct most or all of their entire dealings with government online. 3 in 5 people used the internet to access government services in 2007, a 20% increase compared with 2004-05 usage rates. The report found that Australians value the convenience that the internet provides in their dealings with government agencies. All of these developments suggest that we're in the process of a profound social and economic transition. But what is the role for government in this transition? The transition towards the digital economy represents the next frontier. It is the government's responsibility to ensure that Australia has the infrastructure, the competence, the skills and the regulatory settings in place to embrace an effective transition towards a fully-fledged digital economy. This government's vision is to position Australia as a highly competitive and innovative knowledge-based economy. This vision will not be achieved by one policy in isolation, however important that might be. Over time, it will require government to consider a range of coordinated policy measures and responses in a range of areas. This includes ensuring that the necessary infrastructure and regulatory frameworks are in place, and ensuring that the necessary protections are in place to enable Australians to plug into the digital economy safely. The government's vision for Australia's transition to a digital economy is based on a number of clear and sound policy principles. Australians should have access to the best infrastructure and services possible in order to maximise the potential benefits from the transition to the digital economy. Connectivity should be available to all Australians, irrespective of where they choose to live or work. And the affordability of services, including for disadvantaged members of our society, is a critical element of the equation and an important policy focus for government. Australians should be protected from cyber safety and e-security threats and assured that they will have access to new and innovative services as they emerge. It is critical that the government provides leadership in this area, not only by setting out clear and sound principles, but also by getting the policy and regulatory settings right to ensure that they are promoted. I'd like to step through a number of areas of policy reform we have underway to maximise the benefits of the digital economy for all Australians. One area of particular focus for the government is the efficient management and use of our national radio spectrum assets. Spectrum is used for key communications in the modern world. Television, mobile telephony, wireless broadband, satellite broadband, emergency services, security, logistics tracking, to name but a few. It is a core plank of our national infrastructure. The Rudd government recognises the importance of spectrum and intends to make sure that we maximise the potential benefits for Australian consumers and industry. New and emerging wireless technologies deliver some obvious productivity benefits. However, spectrum also provides a huge economic benefit to a developed economy. A recent study estimated that radio spectrum contributed £42 billion to the British economy in 2005-06. There is no reason to believe that the benefit would be any smaller here as a proportion of the economy. Many other economies have already completed reviews on key radio spectrum issues and are moving into a decision-making phase. The Australian government also wants to progress spectrum reform. Considerable work is now required to position ourselves so that we, and I emphasise we, this is not just about the government, can make informed judgments. An area attracting particular attention is the transition from analogue to digital television. The television industry is well underway in moving to digital and production and delivery platforms, and many developing countries have already made the switch or are in the process of switching to digital TV. The Rudd government wants to ensure that Australia is not left behind and that the switchover is completed with minimum disruption and maximum benefit for Australians. The government has set December 31st, 2013 as the date for completing the switch off of analogue TV. We've established the Digital Switchover Task Force and allocated $37.9 million for a range of measures to ensure a smooth transition. Digital television will deliver a range of benefits for consumers, including better quality picture and the provision of additional channels. It will also deliver a national benefit as spectrum previously allocated for analogue broadcasting signals becomes available for new uses. Known as a digital dividend, some estimates put the value of this spectrum at close to $1 billion. Spectrum realised in the switch off of analogue television broadcasts should enable the launch of new services, including wireless internet, mobile telephony, and broadcasting services. The government has started consultation on the digital dividend and other spectrum reform issues and is committed to ensure we maximise the potential benefits of this key national infrastructure asset. Now, the government's policy for a national broadband network has received a lot of attention, and I know I have spoken at this forum before about some of these issues, but if I could just recap a little and then expand on where we're at. Before the election, we committed to make up to $4.7 billion in order to facilitate the rollout of a high-speed broadband network to 98% of Australian homes and businesses. As some of you heard me say before, $4.7 billion rolls off my tongue pretty easy now because I've been saying it for the best part of 2 years. But I've got to tell you, if you take the tax cuts package out of the election commitments of the Rudd then opposition, this was the single largest spend outside of the tax cuts. Bigger than health, bigger than education, bigger than any of all the other ones you would think of, Labor government. This was the biggest, bar tax cuts. That's how serious Kevin Rudd and this government are about trying to get this right. The widespread availability and affordability of first-class broadband services is a first-order priority for the Rudd government. The National Broadband Network will rival the Snowy Mountains scheme in its scale and national significance. It will provide infrastructure to transform our society and our economy, moving us confidently into the digital age. The National Broadband Network will be foundation infrastructure that will support services and applications that people need now and those innovations that will emerge in the future. Since the release of the request for proposals, there has been a range of speculation and commentary by some commentators on the government's broadband policy. I'd like to take this opportunity to reiterate a couple of things about the upcoming assessment process. This is precisely why I've appointed a panel of experts with a range of specialist experience to assess proposals and provide me with a recommendation. The request for proposals has been designed to maximise competitive tension and encourage innovative proposals. And we are working to ensure that proponents will have access to relevant network information to assist in the preparation of their bids. Now, I know there are a range of parties out there with the interests, skills and capabilities to get involved in this process and put forward seriously competitive proposals, and I encourage them to do so. But just in the last 72 hours, we've seen one potential bidder say, right, unless it's a structural separation, we're not bidding. And another potential bidder saying, it's a structural separation, we're not bidding. Welcome to communications policy. So I expect this sort of gaming to go on. I expect for $4.7 billion contracts there to be robust debate about what the structure of the industry should be, what the regulatory framework of the industry should be. But we're not going to be responding on a daily basis to one side trying to position themselves in this debate ahead of the other. If I'd have listened to all of the input from all of the sector, there would be no bidders because they would have mutually excluded each other from the bidding process. So let me take this opportunity to reiterate another point about this process. The government has always recognised that it may need to consider regulatory or legislative changes to facilitate the deployment of the national broadband network. The request for proposals invites proponents to put forward structural measures or models to address the government's objectives of competition and a genuine open access regime. Labor opposed the current operational separation regime that applies to Telstra because we regarded it as ineffective. We voted against it in Parliament. Now in government, we've not changed our view. We are prepared to carefully look at structural arrangements similar to those adopted in countries such as the UK, New Zealand and Singapore. The regulatory arrangements and structures around the national broadband network are a central consideration in this process. This is why I have also called separately for submissions on what the regulatory settings should look like. The government is determined to ensure that the arrangements are in place to promote robust competition in the market for delivering services over the new network. Now, as I said before, the national broadband network will be a key driver in Australia's transition to a fully fledged digital economy. The national broadband network will accelerate the rate at which Australians are plugging into the digital economy. Yet many of the opportunities that come with a connected world bring with them risks and dangers which we cannot be blind to. There are emerging e-security threats and vulnerabilities that pose a challenge to the effective and efficient use of new technologies. Governments and the private sector need to work together across jurisdictions to improve cyber safety, combat spam, and protect privacy for consumers and minors. Concerns about security, trust and privacy are also barriers to users buying online. Recent OECD figures show that in the EU, over 30% of internet users do not buy online because of security concerns. In Australia, this figure is about 20%. As the most vulnerable segment of the Australian digital economy, home users, students and small businesses need to be aware of these security risks and have the tools to protect themselves from threats. The government has adopted an integrated approach that addresses e-security risks to Australian government networks, critical infrastructure, home users and small businesses. We are focusing our efforts on a number of areas. For example, we're educating parents, children, teachers and businesses on the risk of online engagement and empowering them with the skills to avoid the dangers. And we are engaging with industry to set priorities for action. We're also making sure we're informed of emerging issues and solutions by conducting research and keeping abreast of what the rest of the world is doing in relation to cyber safety and e-security. Addressing these issues is a vital component in maintaining trust and confidence, not only in the internet, but within the wider digital economy. I mean, one of the things that at the moment people say, oh, look, we've got to make sure we educate parents. Don't have the computer in the kid's bedroom. Have it out in the family room. Good advice, only one problem. It's called convergence. And you can't make them make every phone call on their phone from the dining room or the family room. Because now that if an iPhone 6 next year. I mean, you can do this now on 3G. But when iPhone hits next year, that's convergence, it's happening. You get everything you want. iPhone's going 3G. You've got all of the things you think you're stopping your kid looking at in your family room, on your phone, in their bedroom. So the advice that says, oh, look, you fixed it by parental supervision, by having it in the family room, is redundant. It's redundant as soon as you give them their own mobile phone that connects to the internet. Now, you can put blocking devices in so they can only use it for various purposes. That's true. But this idea that it's just enough to, say, educate parents and then parents can make sure that it's in their lounge room or in their family room, it's not going to be enough. So the government has identified three priorities to provide an integrated approach to Australia's e-security. The first of these priorities is reducing the e-security risk to Australian government information and communication systems. The second is reducing the e-security risk to Australia's national critical infrastructure. And third is enhancing the protection of home users and small and medium-sized businesses from electronic attacks and fraud. To ensure parents and teachers have confidence in the internet as a valuable educational and social tool, we need to address the online risks to children, which is why the government has a cyber safety policy. This policy focuses on education, research, law enforcement, and on managing current threats through technical mechanisms such as ISP-level filtering of illegal material, including child pornography. A range of awareness and education measures will focus on teaching a generation of children to be good cyber citizens. We don't go a week now without finding out a story from either locally or overseas about cyberbullying. It's going on 24/7 now because kids have got their mobile phones, they're texting away, they're sending and posting stuff on YouTube and MySpace and all this sort of stuff. This sort of bullying now has moved to an entirely new dimension. So a range of awareness and education measures will focus on teaching a generation of children, as I said, to be good cyber citizens. So as I set out today, this government has a clear vision for Australia's digital future. To make this vision a reality, we need sound policy and leadership. We are pursuing a coordinated approach. We will ensure that Australians have the infrastructure, confidence, skills and regulatory environment needed to take full advantage of the digital economy. By keeping an eye on the future, we can create a foundation for economic prosperity for the decades to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. And so we come to question and discussion time. Once again, thanks to Westpac for this facility. Can I just... You've been in office now about 5 months or thereabouts. So you're about 15% through your term. How would you... how would you depict the Rudd government as different from the Howard government? And, I mean, in the first 5 months and for the next year or so?
Sure. Look, can I promise you that the story or the slogan Kevin 24/7, it's not a myth. For any of you who've even dealt with or tried to deal with it, it is really not a myth. Kevin sets an unbelievable pace. I'd be unlucky enough to have spent every single day of the 11 and a half years in opposition. I came in 96. So there is an absolute pent-up desire, not just from myself, but from all of the colleagues around the cabinet table, around the full ministry, the parliamentary backbench, to actually try and start changing the direction of Australia. And changing for the better, we will argue. I mean, some may disagree. So we've already taken a number of very big steps in terms of climate change. We've already taken some big steps in terms of foreign policy around Iraq and Afghanistan. We said, time to bring the troops home out of Iraq. And to have a greater emphasis and focus in our region around Afghanistan. The budget is pretty tricky. Even 5 months ago when we won government, I think people would have quite predicted the circumstances. We've got a world economy with the US teetering on recession. We've got demand starting to slip around the world. But Australian economy is bumping along at almost full capacity. And as Laurie Abbs showed with an FOI on his TV news show last night, the Treasury wrote to John Howard and said, hey, if you keep spending like this, you're going to create inflationary pressures because the economy is at full capacity. So we have a really tricky balance to make about wanting to manage the domestic economy to slow it down at the same time as not want to push it into a situation where the world economy is slowing down and it starts to drag us with it. There's a real challenge that Wayne and Kevin have been working on, and next week's budget I think will meet those challenges. So I think you're seeing in terms of the pace, Kevin's wanted to be more consultative. Probably the thing that Kevin is most determined to achieve next week in the budget is to deliver on our election promises. So in terms of what is the difference, I think even Hawke broke a few promises in his first budget. Howard certainly had core and non-core promises. Kevin is determined to deliver all of our election promises. He values the integrity of the relationship with the Australian public. He values the consultations you see in our community cabinets that we've been going around Australia, talking to Australians. Out at Penrith, we had nearly 600 people turn up to talk. And literally, it is an open forum, and you can get asked anything. He's got the entire cabinet there. He's up there himself, and he just takes whatever questions get thrown at him and passes them on to relevant ministers as well. So he's consultative, he's open, there's changes to FOI laws that are coming. So he wants to run a more transparent and open government. He wants to engage in a dialogue, we've seen 2020. Lots of challenging ideas. Some, as he said, we'd accept some of the ideas and we'd think about some of the ideas and we'd say no to some of the ideas. So we're putting together responses to that for the end of the year. So I think you find him more consultative and more dynamic. I think clearly the Howard government had got tired by the end. And so we're determined to pick up the pace, particularly in the areas of reform. Talked about some of them here. Wayne's got a lot on his plate. There's a whole range of ministers that want to make reforms right across the plate. Our biggest problem is there's a queue to get material into cabinet. I've got to tell you, it's very frustrating. We're really keen to try and get some early runs on the board.
Okay, there's a question here. Yeah.
Minister, you mentioned in your speech about the switch off of analogue television at the end of 2013. You also mentioned that frees up a large pile of spectrum. There's been talk by you and others about the potential to create a fourth free-to-air commercial TV network. You spoke about that in opposition. What's your views on that now that you're in
the movie? Look, I was asked this question the other day in a public forum. And I give the same answer we gave in opposition. It's something that should be on the table for consideration when that spectrum becomes free. So I envisage that will certainly be a very active part of our consideration. There's a whole range of changes that are taking place. I mean, pay TV has got a whole range of concessions that's got introduced over many years because it was an infant industry almost. It's outgrowing the infant industry tag. So there's a range of issues around regulation in pay TV. There's a range of issues about freeing up and having a more competitive free-to-air network. So all of those things are going to be part of the debate over the next year or two as we're preparing for that switch-off date. So we've said exactly what we said in opposition. It should be on the table and it should be part of the considerations.
Question
here,
let me go over there. Yeah.
Minister, has the criteria for the contract, if you will, for broadband been established as yet? And second question is, could you comment on, for instance, Optus criticism of it favouring Telstra?
Sure. Look, the RFP is on the website, it's on the Department of website. If you want to go through it, it sets out, it's quite a long document, but it's $4.7 billion. So, as I said, this is a huge project. So, but it's up there on the website. You can download it, have a look at it. There's a couple of other regulatory papers saying, hey, give us information, tell us what you think of the regulatory regime. So don't just download that. There's two or three other bits you need to get across. In terms of Optus' criticism, Optus wanted to us to say that you couldn't bid unless you agreed to structural separation. Telstra said about bid is the structural separation. So you've got, as I said, a fair bit of gaming going on. Telstra, they said, put up a $100 million bond to be able to bid. That would exclude everybody else. Optus's proposal would have excluded Telstra. So welcome to my life in communications. In terms of the time frame, this is a fast time frame. This is ambitious. We're not mucking around. We accept that we are pushing hard on this because this is something we believe. Every day that goes by that we don't have genuine high-speed broadband available to Australian kids, Australian businesses, is a day we sit further behind the rest of the world. The US, Canada, Singapore, Germany, I could go on and on with all the countries that are actually deploying fibre and wanting to get the best possible broadband to their populations as fast as they can. So I accept that this is a fast time frame. It does depend on a couple of things. It depends on an important bill getting through Parliament next week. Now, we don't control the Senate. So if the opposition want to play games around some of the legislation that's necessary to support the bill, well, there's going to be, firstly, a very healthy public debate about why the Coalition don't want fast broadband to reach Australians. And I can tell you, I'll be on every street corner around regional, rural Australia and everywhere else to say the reason you haven't got fast broadband is because they're blocking it in the Senate. So there's a critical bill next week, the real test for the opposition next week. They got the numbers, they can block the bill, but it's an important bill that delivers the information necessary for the bid. Haven't got the information, bid can't go very far, very fast. So there's a real test for the opposition next week about whether or not they're going to stand in the way of the process.
There's a question down there. Rafa, do you want to give the...
Thanks, Minister. I'd like to draw you out on some of your comments on cyber and internet security. And in particular, the responsibility of ISPs. It seems that in the past, the ISPs have said, well, they're not really responsible for a lot of the stuff that goes over goes through our networks, and we're not really responsible for a lot of the threats that you elicited over on. To what extent would you think it wise to push the ISP industry to take a little bit more responsibility?
Look, can I say that... We announced before the election that we wanted to have mandatory filtering. This was not warmly welcomed. The level of opposition in the ISP community has not diminished. We're engaged in, at times, robust debate with them. And they're still not very keen to take any responsibility. Their view is, well, just the road, it doesn't matter. It's not our responsibility that gets driven on the road. I say you're a distribution platform. And I don't know many distribution platforms that get to take no responsibility for what gets pushed on it. So we are engaged. We're going to go through some trials, both laboratory and then real-world trials. And I think there's been some softening, can I say, and importantly, from some big ISPs on some of these issues. And so I think, despite the public positioning, I think there is some level of sensible thinking coming from some of the ISPs, which I really welcome. So I think initially they are very strongly opposed. We won the election, they're still very strongly opposed, but they're realising we are serious about this. So they want to engage with us. And we've committed to work through this process because there are genuine technical issues. I mean, yes, it is possible to design a mandatory filter that grinds the internet to a halt. That's if you want to design it that way. Equally, it's possible to design one that doesn't grind it to a halt. So there are plenty of examples around the world where people are meeting these challenges. None of this, can I stress, none of this is a silver bullet. Okay, people should not think, let's say we pass the law tomorrow and it was introduced, bam. Okay, this will not absolutely protect our kids because the Russian mafia are pretty smart. You block one website name, they're going to change it. They're going to move around. These people make a lot of money from this bill. So this is not something that is a one silver bullet. That's why we have all these other legs for the cyber safety policy. Education, law enforcement, international cooperation. I mean, I was in Bangkok a week and a half ago talking to the APEC economies about how we could work together with their blacklists and our blacklists and add them together so that we can have a comprehensive blacklist. Now, comprehensive in terms of compared to where we're at now, but in terms of all of the potential material that we probably wouldn't want kids to see. And I'm talking child porn here. I'm not talking... just the average run-of-the-mill porn. I'm talking this really filthy stuff that that's banned at the moment. We want to ensure stays banned. So we are dead serious. And a few of the internets, some large ISPs, are actually starting to put forward some very constructive suggestions.
Question there?
Senator, with broadband rollout, I think you mentioned that you're after a fast timetable. What are some of the dates and milestones that you're busy?
I think we put it out on April 11th. I think the close is the end of July. Don't hold me to the absolute date, but about the end of the July. There's a couple of months for the expert panel to assess these proposals, and that gets us towards September for the government then to be involved in a process that will I'm sure still see some negotiation at the end of the day. They are, as I said, they represent their interests robustly. And Helen Cooney can attest to that. But that's the sort of time frame. We hope, our ambition is for the rollout to be commencing by the end of the year. Now that's an ambitious timetable, but that's the timetable that we're working towards.
There's a question there. Yep.
Minister, what's the government's position on the rollout of digital radio, given most of what I've seen written about it is fairly negative and hasn't been in support of it as a technology? Mm-hmm. Do you see it supplanting analog radio the way digital TV?
There are no plans to switch off analog radio. That's probably the first thing to say. If you look at what's happened in the UK, and they're very well advanced, there's actually a lot of positives that have come out of the digital radio in the UK. There's lots of new channels that are, if you like, specialist channel, a jazz channel, a classical channel. So there has been a very positive experience in the UK. We, like with digital television, have been much slower. Now, I could spend hours talking about why that is. What I'd say to you is, notwithstanding any reluctance in the part previously of either digital free-to-air broadcasters or incumbent radios, they're all now behind us. I mean, the start-up for digital radio is, I think, 1st of January. So there are positive experiences. I think, though, there is a challenge. Already kids are moving onto the next stream. They're downloading. They're not listening to radios. They're watching their iPods. They're listening to their iPods. So I think there's a real challenge that technology is probably advanced a bit faster than our deployment of digital technologies here in Australia, and that's not a credit to the previous government, because we got left behind, and that's why it's important to take a fast time frame to try and make sure we don't get left behind. But in general, I'd still say to you, on balance, I think the UK demonstrated us some positive experiences from going down the digital radio path, but there's never been a suggestion we'd be switching off the analog radios once we started the digital radio. No one's going to be flicking that switch.
Not to create more spectrum down the track.
No, look, not to flick that switch. No, the challenge of the TV switch off. Can I say this is as big as decimal currency? If you think about how many TVs you've got in your home. Okay, this isn't just okay. We fixed the one in the lounge. And I got like three, maybe four, and I'm sure most of you've got at least two, if not three. In the home, because no one ever throws a TV away. As soon as you get the bigger one, you know, you just move that one into the bedroom, or that one from the bedroom to the kid's bedroom, and you've got a couple of kids, and each one's got one. They're like, they breed like rabbits. So to actually flick the switch after you've just fixed up the one TV. So, and then there's video recorders. I mean, you're going to need to adapt all your existing analog technology for the switch off there. So this is a huge, huge expedition. To switch off digital TV. And look, maybe some brave soul will come along and think in a few years' time that we should do the same with radio, but I'm focused on the TV one for the moment, and I've got a few other big things on my plate, so that one will probably need someone else when I retire in 15 or 20 years' time.
You've got something on the IQ tonight, haven't you?
What's tonight, Tuesday?
A fan of the IQ.
Yeah, no, look... The exciting news, I mean, I'll plug the IQ anyway, because I think it's a great piece of technology. For any of you who've got Foxtel, it is a fabulous piece of technology. Finally, free-to-air have got together. They're going to have a freeview box similar to what they've got in the UK, which is going to have all the capacities. Foxtel will probably shoot me for saying that, but it's going to match roughly the capacities of the IQ box. So you're actually starting to see free-to-airs get on board. There's going to be 15 channels with ABC, SBS having two or three, the HD channels for the free-to-airs, the SD channels that come on stream next year. So you're looking for a package of about 15, which will have all of that capacity as well. But I think Dexter's on a Thursday night. Might be Law and Order tonight. Might be Law and Order.
$4.7 billion grant money. Why isn't the government interested in a sort of equity position? Or
no, we set our preferred position is an equity position. That's stated in our in the document.
But in the infrastructure itself.
Yeah, no. Our preferred position is equity in the company that builds the infrastructure. That's our preferred position. I mean, that's going to be part of the negotiation, but it's clearly stated. Our preferred position is an equity
partner in this project. But we're prepared to consider other structures. You know, PPPs and PPPs nowadays have a very broad definition. So what is equity to one person is actually debt to another under the current rules of the stock exchange. No. It is stated that our preference is an equity position.
And could that end up in the futures fund?
The income stream earned from the equity goes back into the future fund.
Right. Yes.
Minister, just on the 4.7 issue, how did you come up with 4.7 and what's your estimate of the total cost of the issue?
Yeah. We based our cost estimate on a proposal that actually Telstra put to the former government. It was to build an ADSL 2+ network. And the Telstra put forward about 3.4 for themselves and said, look, we can do 5 capital cities in this, and you need about 4.7 billion. You need to give us 4.7 billion to reach about 98% of the population. And that was an ADSL 2+ network. Since we announced our plan over 2 years ago now, VDSL has come on to the market. VDSL will mean that, and I think both Telstra and the Optus G&I sort of indicated they will probably build a VDSL network rather than an ADSL network. That will increase the cost, not to the Commonwealth. Ours is capped at $4.7 billion. Now, it's a different chipset rather than ADSL 2+. But the difference in cost, and no one's actually fully costed the VDSL one, and as I said, I say, hey, look, that's fabulous. You're going to be delivering minimum 20 meg, maximum 50 meg to probably 60% of Australian homes with a VDSL network. But we're not paying any more. The difference is that the ADSL network, to deliver those really fast speeds, to punch them out, you need to be about 1.5 kilometres from the node. That's green boxes for anyone. There's lots of green boxes you've walked past in the street. You never know what they are. They're usually graffiti, covered by trees and shrubs. That's actually a node. And we're converting those grey pillars to nodes to achieve. That's actually how you do the trick of the speeds. You need to be about 1,500 metres from a node is your catchment area to get the truly fast speed. For VDSL, you need to be about 900 metres. So there is an increase in number of nodes and conversions because you go to the next technology. So it's a more expensive project if you go down the VDSL path. But as I stress, not for the Commonwealth.
Thanks, Minister. I heard you just say 5 capital cities. Does that leave out Darwin and...
Absolutely. The original proposal, which the Howard government was championing about their national broadband network, was 5 capital cities. I'm not talking Canberra, I'm not talking Hobart, I'm not talking Darwin, and it was only about half of Adelaide. They were prepared to do a bit of the Gold Coast, Sunshine Coast, because there's, you know, a bit of growth there, and a bit of the North Coast up to Newcastle from here. So they're prepared to look at those pockets. But literally, those other capitals, not on the map originally. When they first announced it, my Tasmanian colleagues went nuts. Within 24 hours of their announcement of their plan for 5 capital cities, it took 24 hours, Hobart was on the map. Then in true Tasmanian style, it took another 24 hours, and Launceston might have been on the map. So there was quite literally a bit of a bidding process that emerged politically, but that was because my Tasmanian colleagues said we've been left off the map again. This is like the Commonwealth Games. Or the ABC local radio awards, Mark, but I won't mention that.
Yes, question here.
Minister, during your remarks, you mentioned that expressed concern that countries like Canada and the US, Germany, are moving ahead more rapidly with broadband. But Australia has a long tradition of being an early adopter of technology. In this case, are there some advantages to being maybe not on the bleeding edge of some of these technologies?
Yeah, look, people often say to me, oh, Steve, you're investing in fibre, you know, you're picking your technology. Yeah. Can I give you a quick rundown of why this is just wrong? Okay. I'll use the train example. Fibre is the track. You can put any steam locomotive on the track if you want, through to electric, through to whatever jet-propelled locomotive you want. Broadband is the same. Most people think that wireless broadband and mobile phones. When you make a phone call, I'm phoning my best mate in Perth. He's the State Secretary of the of the Labor Party in Western Australia, and he's having a good couple of days, I've got to tell you. He's had a very good couple of days. He's actually running for election at the end of the year for a Western Australian seat, so he's having a very good day. And most people think that when you make a phone call, it travels all the way from your phone, through the air, all the way over the purse, into their phone and back. So of that distance, what percentage do you think actually goes through the air? And what percentage do you think travels on fibre? Most people would, maybe 50, it's about 95. Because what happens is, when you press your phone, it goes to the nearest tower, it's on top of this building or wherever, and it gets sucked down into the ground onto a piece of fibre. And it's pumped along the piece of fibre at the speed of light. And no one's yet invented anything faster than the speed of light, no matter how much the wireless broadband people try and convince us they have. And it goes from the nearest tower to the recipient, up and through the air to them. So I say to wireless providers, think of this as nothing more, and apologies for the bit of jargon now, think of this as nothing more than the biggest piece of backhaul you've ever seen that will help reduce prices for wireless products as well. So I'm not, wireless broadband mobile phones operate on fibre. It is the core piece of, it is the railway track that the locomotive can be any sort you want on top of. So people say, oh, you're picking fibre. I'm not picking the technology. I'm putting the railroad track down. And 100 years after railroads are still built, they're still using the same piece of track. Tragically, that's one of the problems. But the thing about fibre is once it's in the ground, to upgrade it, and this is the thing about the fibre technology, the fibre debate, you just, I'm going to be really, really scientific and technical here. Okay? You've got this big fat pipe in the ground, and you've got a box on the end of it. All you do to upgrade from ADSL to VDSL is rip the box off and put the new smart box on. And you just keep ripping the boxes off. That's the technical technospeak there. Okay? But that's fundamentally what happens with a piece of fibre and upgrades in technology. Once you've got the fibre in the ground, it's the box on the end that makes a difference.
Question there.
Yeah.
Minister, you
talk about providing services to 98% of the population. Is there a strategy for the other two?
Yeah, no. Look, I mentioned when a gentleman asked about other papers. There is a third paper. I said get them all. The third paper talks about the 2%. It says, what is the latest technology, satellite, wireless, microwave, to deliver to the 2%? Because, and so we called for submissions on how to best service the 2%. So I apologize. I spent all my time talking about the 98%. But we've actually said, tell us what you think the best new technologies are. I mean, if I had a dollar for every satellite provider told me they can punch 12 meg through a thunderstorm, I'd be a rich man. We have Bill Glasson. Dr. Bill Glasson is the head of the AMA. He's doing a regional task force for the government. It started under the previous government, to be fair. He's going around Australia. He has access to up to nearly $400 million to put forward proposals around the 2%. So I'm comfortable we're going to be doing something very... We're going to be improving broadband for all Australians, and Bill's going to be putting forward some proposals later this year around the 2%.
That extends to mobile telephony?
It can include mobile telephony as well.
Okay, so we'll go right down the back of it. Yeah.
Just hopping back to spectrum and television for one moment. Are the AMD licences better buried, or you might reconsider those at some time?
Yeah, now look, can I say to you that I kept reading all through last year, the auction was imminent. The hard decisions were done. Yeah, and then by the time we got to nearing August, they were ready to go in August, but the election was too close, that would disrupt it, we'd have to stop. I got to tell you, nothing could be farther from the truth. The AMB licence we used as a bargaining chip with the National Party to deliver cross-media reform. They promised all these wonderful new services through AMB as part of the carrot for the National Party. If anybody in the marketplace had seen the conditions that are attached currently under the former government's proposal to AMB, they would vanish without trace. Take a guess on what sort of coverage you think you'd have to promise a National Party member and senator of Australia to get them to vote for cross media. And I'm telling you, it ain't five capital cities. So, not completely non-viable. The attached conditions to what I inherited would make it unviable. So this one is an egg I'm having to try and unscramble. This is a nightmare. This is tougher than turning off the CDMA network. This is tougher than taking $1 billion back from Opal. This is tougher than the national broadband network RFP debate that we're having at the moment. This one is a nightmare. This is, the promises that were made about where this was at were just not correct. It is fundamentally not ready to go to markets. I'm having to completely reassess it. There's all sorts of issues around community broadcasting that were never addressed. There are spectrum issues in Sydney. There are spectrum issues in the Gold Coast. There are spectrum issues through Brisbane and up into the Sunshine Coast that were just never addressed because these required some hard decisions. And in the lead-up to an election, the previous government were not interested in making some hard decisions. So I've taken an absolute step back. It's not that I'm not thinking about it. I'm thinking about it consistently. But this one is actually a bigger mess than any of those other things I've just mentioned.
Yes. We'll make this the second last question here.
Minister, back in 94, when the Kenny government was in office, they took about 3 years after the Beyond the Duopoly paper to actually set up the post-97 regulatory regime. It was quite a protracted process, as you know. Your very fast timetable, which is admirable, seems very aggressive given what could be the dimension of regulatory change needed here to deal with this. I mean, are you willing to actually move the timing out in order to make sure the regulatory settings are...
Look, the great thing about the telco sector is while I have an ambitious timetable, it is not a surprise to them. It's actually been sitting there staring at them for at least 5 months since we were elected. And if you've read any of the papers that I've written on it over the last 2.5 years, you'll see we've actually been dead serious. We've stuck to our position, we haven't budged. And the regulatory issue has been staring at people in the face now, and people have very entrenched positions. It's not like there's a lot of new thinking that's gone on in the last couple of years on this issue. I'm actually encouraging people to try and think, you know, about the new structure and what regulatory settings we have. And when we get past the gaming side of the debate, this is not new. It's like Optus G9 actually put in an access undertaking to the ACCC for a 5 capital city network. They've already done all that work. All of it, apparently it's vanished. Apparently, maybe if they ring Graham Samuel, he'll give them a copy of the work they submitted to him. But an enormous amount of work has already gone into the preparation of a document that could perhaps be enhanced a little bit to reach a stage where they could submit it to us. But I'm not sure waiting another 6 months will change the position of Optus or Telstra about trying to exclude the other from the bid. I'm not a pessimist. Maybe, Phil, did you make it, Phil? Did you find the building? No, Phil didn't find the building. You did. How are you, mate?
Just a final question. I think we bumped into one another just before the election. I think you told me then that you were going to lots of meetings in rural and regional Australia. You were very surprised about the number of people that were turning up and the great deal of interest, and obviously this played a role in the election outcome, clearly. But if you were going back to these same kind of people in 2.5 years before the next election, do you feel you will be able to meet the expectations you created in the lead-up to November 2007?
Look, firstly, we said it was a 5-year bill. We didn't try and pretend to anyone in these meetings. This is a 5-year bill, so this is a massive piece of infrastructure. The Snowy Mountains in today's dollars is about $6 billion. This is going to be somewhere north of 10. I use that example to give you the magnitude of building a national broadband network. Now, you may think, why is it going to take that long? Can I promise you it's not because it's going to take 5 years to dig a trench and put a piece of cable in. The actual physical transition on the street corner, as you actually change the millions and millions and millions of phone lines is where you actually get to the speed. But this is not something that you have to do the entire 5 years, and then Steve Conroy has a big ceremony and flicks the switch at the end of 5 years. So the node or the pillar, when you lift it up, when you've spliced and diced and you put them on the new network, you flick the switch in every street as you do it, in every suburb as you do it, in every town as you do it. So we will have made good progress by then. We said to everywhere I went, the first question everyone asked me, can we be first? After 43 meetings, I think I'd have been killed if I'd have actually promised 43 of them they could be first. So I was very honest about it. I said, look, I can't promise you that you're going to be first. What I can say to you is I'm prepared to talk to the bidders about what's the best way to build the network. Do you build it, as they describe it, outward in or inward out? And many people said, well, look, the fairest way to do it is to deal with those who have got the worst broadband now. Now, you don't need to think, oh, I'm on the tip of Cape York at this point. I can take you to Adelaide. The ABS just reduced their census figures, where people themselves filled in, what's your broadband like? Hobart, 32%. 32% broadband, Hobart. 33% Adelaide. 41 or 42% Perth. We're talking major capital cities. I loved campaigning in Perth. They were feral about their lack of broadband. Their economy is bubbling along so long, and they're getting third-rate broadband. Adelaide, angry. Angry about lack of broadband. The economy's doing pretty well. You go to Tasmania, I've got to tell you, Tasmania sort of used to being left off the map, quite literally. They just go, oh, yeah, no, everyone makes these promises. You know. So Tassie are just used to it. But seriously, you don't need to be on the tip of Cape York to be not getting decent broadband in this country. You can be living in 5 minutes from the CBD of Melbourne, 5 minutes from the CBD of Sydney, and all throughout the rest of capital city Australia. So this is a five-year build to try and address this. So we never promised people, like the previous government, that we could deliver this before the next election. We were not that dishonest to try and pretend we could deliver them genuine high-speed broadband and take them into the 21st century in an election timetable of 3 years. We said it was 5 years. It will be a challenge given the capacity constraints in the economy to meet a five-year timetable. I mean, this economy is can beat it with a stick just about, as the Reserve Bank are trying to slow it down. So this is a challenging timetable. So we're confident we'll have started the rollout. We've already, with Telstra, enabled, how many is it now, Phil?
2.6 million.
2.6 million Australian homes now, because we switched on, is it just over 1,000 exchanges?
Yeah,
907 exchanges we've enabled with ADSL 2 Plus. And that took a bit of negotiation, argument back and forwards with Telstra, but we got there. And literally 2.6 million Australians have already got faster broadband. It's not as fast as we want, but it's already a first step. So I think we'll be in a position to be able to say to Australians, we are starting to deliver on our promise. Thank you very much.
There are more questions, but we always finish on time, so I'll just be very brief. Senator Conroy has always been a good friend of the Sydney Institute. It's great to have him back again. He gave an important speech before the last election, and now a report on what's happened in the last 5 months. So, well done tonight. As you said, it's a very challenging ministerial responsibility, and we wish you well in the next few years, and we'll see you back here in the not-too-distant future. Many thanks. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.